All right, so just first of all, I know that you arrived on the island over the weekend. Can you tell me a bit about your time in Unalaska so far and what you've been doing?
So far, like on my first day, I came in Saturday afternoon, probably around 2:30, 3 o'clock. I met with the city manager and the assistant city manager, who basically greeted me at the airport, showed me a little bit, and briefly went over the itinerary for this week. Then they helped me out getting to my hotel and getting checked in and everything. Sunday, I was able to meet with the interim police chief, Chief Lucking, and I was also able to meet with several of the members of the public safety department here at City Hall. I toured the police facility or the public safety facility. Was also able to go out to the training range, firing range, and today I'm on the phone with you, hopefully giving the citizens of Unalaska an opportunity to get to know me a little bit better. And then I think later today I'm supposed to do a community tour where I actually get to ride around with the city manager and see more of the city. I'm trying to stay at the hotel as much as possible and limit my interaction just to keep everything safety-wise. And then I believe there's a meeting scheduled this evening at the council chambers, where there's going to be community members have been invited, and I believe some of the city staff will also be there. Tuesday, it's more of this meeting with the directors of the other city departments, and I believe getting to discuss the inner workings of the city itself with the city manager, and then I leave out on Wednesday to go back home.
Okay, so you're a finalist for the position of police chief here in Unalaska, and we're a long way from Montgomery, Alabama, where you're coming from. So what is it about Unalaska? Why are you potentially looking forward to coming here?
I like to vacation, and the places I go to vacation are usually mountains or water. And I've actually taken a couple of trips up to Alaska. I've been on a cruise to Alaska. I've visited several cities to include, Anchorage, Juneau, Hoonah, Ketchikan, now Unalaska. And I love the state. It has a lot of what I like as far as the community goes. There's smaller communities. I live in a city of 215, 210, 215,000 people, and during the week, being the capital city, you got have an influx of about 50 to 70,000 people. And I grew up living in Montgomery and in a small community called Wetumpka, where my mother was born and raised. And after 26 years of serving in a larger community, I just feel that I want to be in a smaller community where I can actually get to know the people that I work with and that I serve in the community. And with Unalaska being an island community, I love the mountains. I love the military history here. I love the native culture that I've learned about so far. I like the fact that, it's just a majestic place to be, and it feels like it could be home.
That's good to hear, and especially in such a short time here so far. So, can you walk me through a bit of your past work experience and why you're qualified for the position of police chief here in Unalaska?
Well, at the age of 17, my mother signed papers for me to join the military. I actually joined the Alabama Army National Guard in December of 1990. Served as a military police officer from December 1990 through December 1997, where I received an honorable discharge. In 1994, I was actually hired by the city of Montgomery. I spent 18 months in patrol and then transferred to traffic homicide, where I worked 5.5 years. And then ultimately, being promoted to the rank of sergeant, I was assigned to the administrative division. From 2002 to present, I basically have been in the administrative division in different capacities. I served as a police desk supervisor, communication supervisor, logistics unit commander, IT commander. And for a brief time, I was an acting captain where I served over our community policing, canine, animal control, school resources, and a small area that is downtown we call the Entertainment District. It's a patrol area. And then, of course, I came back to admin as a desk services commander, as a captain. And then ultimately, I was transferred to our Office of Professional Standards, where I served as the CLIA accreditation manager. I basically worked about 2.5-3 years through the accreditation process to get the Montgomery Police Department accredited through CLIA, which, if you're not familiar with CLIA, it's the Commission on Accreditation for Law Enforcement Agencies. It basically is an organization set up to encourage law enforcement departments to provide policies and procedures that basically protect the officer, protect the department, protect the community, based on having the best practices when it comes to having policies and procedures in place. After that, I was promoted to the rank of major and took over the administrative division as its commander. And recently, I was selected to serve as our department's very first night watch commander. The chief of police is in charge during the day and the night watch commander is in charge at night. So I have the trust of the police chief to handle what he handles during the daytime, during the nighttime hours. Throughout my career, I've sought out training through IACP and also our Alabama Association of Chiefs of Police to receive executive level training. With me having, you know, more than 18 years in the administrative division and pretty much every aspect of admin, stepping into the role of a police chief is something that I think I prepared myself for.
And you've been at the Montgomery Police Department since, is it 1994? Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am. This July will be 26 years.
Wow. And so we have a question from a listener who wants to know kind of what specifically you've done in your personal or professional life to prepare yourself for leading a small department in a remote part of Alaska with limited health, safety, and transportation resources.
Well, throughout my career, like I said, I've always focused on receiving the training and experience needed to be the executive officer of a department. I've gone through extensive FEMA training with ICS. I've attended classes at TEKS in Texas, which is an all-hazards class. I actually serve as one of our ICS instructors for ICS 300 and 400. I've attended training at the Center for Domestic Preparedness. I'm actually a certified instructor through the Center for Domestic Preparedness. I teach at our police academy. Like I said, I've received training through my membership and my attendance in conferences through the International Chief of Police Association, the Alabama Association of Chiefs of Police, and also CLIA. So the experience I have as far as running a unit from 2010 when I was promoted to lieutenant through my current rank as a police major, I've served as a commander over several different size organizations within our department. Like I said, as a special services captain, I was over several different bureaus that I listed earlier. Currently being the night watch commander, I'm over every single unit that operates at night. That includes canine, patrol, investigators, traffic. And I come from a department that is a size where we have an authorized strength of 525 officers. We have a support staff of probably about 150, 200 personnel. So moving from a department that size to a smaller department, I've more than prepared myself for whatever challenges I face here.
All right. Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. I'm Hope McKinney, and I'm here with Major Jay King from the Montgomery Police Department in Alabama, who is a finalist for Unalaska's open police chief position. If you have any questions, you can give us a call at 581-1888 or email us at news@kucb.org. So we're in a really important moment right now. The recent police shootings of Breonna Taylor in Louisville, Kentucky in March, and George Floyd in Minneapolis, Minnesota in late May, and the killings of numerous other Black Americans has sparked protests around the world and a national conversation about the role of policing in communities. I was wondering if you could tell me, what do you believe the role of police should be?
It's very simple. We've always been tasked with protecting life and property. Our job is to serve and protect the citizens that are within our jurisdiction. Law enforcement has always been, try to prevent crime to begin with. But when crime does happen, investigate it, apprehend the wrongdoer, and put them into the criminal justice system by having them go before a judge. And then a judge determines if their punishment is going to be, some type of community service, some type of monetary punitive punishment or incarceration. Our job is merely to find out who did the criminal act and take them before the court. That's our job. The court system and the correction system takes over after that.
But recently, I think we've seen that doesn't always work like it maybe should. And so can you talk more specifically, kind of what does that role of police look like in communities, especially in response to this national conversation about police violence and brutality in this moment?
Well, I think you have to start with an agency that recruits people that have the mindset of serving the community and not using the position for anything other than serving the community. Secondly, you have to have an agency that trains their officers in the proper way to do things. There's a right way and a wrong way to do a traffic stop. There's a right way and a wrong way to question a suspect or to question a witness or to question a victim. Third, you have to have an agency that has policies in place that guide the officers to do the right thing and have protocols in place to where they carry out their job in accordance with what the standards are for that department. And you have to make sure that your policies and procedures are in compliance with local, state, and federal law. There's always going to be that chance of an officer making a mistake, and there's always going to be that chance of an officer misusing their authority. But when that happens, you have to address it. You have to make sure that you're transparent with the community as to, if something happens, why it happened, and what corrective measures you take to keep it from happening again in the future. I've always relied on two things when it comes to policing, and that's data-driven law enforcement and the community policing aspect. Being over our logistics section for the time that I was, I developed, several reports that I passed up through the chain of command so that resources could be allocated to prevent crime from happening, as well as to apprehend those that commit the crimes afterwards. Being a part of an agency like Montgomery Police Department that is very community policing oriented, and serving as the commander over community policing, I found it rewarding to be able to go to neighborhood association meetings to get to know the citizens that live in the area that we police. You're never going to be able to have enough officers put one on every corner and stop every crime, But if you have a good working relationship with the community to where if something happens, you know that those community members feel like, yeah, you're going to do the right thing. Hey, this is what I know. And it helps us apprehend someone who has broken the law. I think that's the type of relationship that you need with the community. At the same time, if an officer oversteps themselves, they need to know that if they come to me as a police chief, that I'm going to address it, that I'm either going to have that officer retrained on proper procedure, have the officer disciplined to where they understand that that action can't take place again, and make sure that I know that when we're trying to hire future officers, that we get the right people on board and trained and on the street. I hate some of the things that other officers do. And recently with everything that's going on, I also don't want, you know, the good men and women who put on the uniform to be, you know, sort of boxed in with the same people who have done bad things. It's one of those things where, I would say, you know, everybody says 99% of officers are good officers. There's 1% that's bad. We have to do a better job of weeding out the bad ones before we hire them. And we have to do a better job of training the ones that we do hire to make sure that they respect the rights of every citizen they come in contact with. Even someone who breaks the law still has rights. They don't lose those rights until the court system puts them into a correctional facility, and then their rights are mandated by the correctional facility. I've always told officers, especially when I worked over our traffic unit, that, you know, when you conduct a traffic stop, first thing you should do is always introduce yourself, tell the person why you pulled them over, and then tell them what you need from them. Not walk up to a car and say, hey, do you know why I pulled you over? It's not their place to tell the officer why the officer pulled them over. It's the officer's place to inform the citizen. So it's little simple things that an officer can do to make the citizen feel more comfortable. It's like, you know, if you pull a citizen over for speeding and you walk up and you say, you know, my name is Major King. The reason I'm stopping is for speeding. I need to see your driver's license, tag, receipt, and insurance card. And then when they say, you know, something like, how, I don't think I was speeding. It's like, well, if an officer says, do you know how slow you were going? It's less offensive of a question and less less likely to put the citizen in a defensive stance than saying, do you know how fast you're going? Because when you say how fast you're going, it's automatically you were doing wrong. But if you say, do you know how slow you were going? Do you know what the speed limit is? It's less likely to put that person into defensive mode. And if you can talk with someone, I think a lot of the things that happen nowadays could be avoided just by proper communication. And training officers on how to speak to someone, even in situations where, say, the person doesn't stop immediately and you have to, you know, follow them a little bit further than the officer would like to follow them. There's usually a reason for that. Like, you know, the person's trying to get to a good spot that they think it's safe to pull over to where the officer's not out in the roadway. Or, you know, they want to get to an area that's a little bit more lit than the area where you initiated the traffic stop. But training officers to, you know, wait until they can understand why that action took place versus, you know, being overzealous or overly aggressive upon initial contact can sometimes guide that interaction to where everything stays peaceful and cordial and in compliance with what the standards of the department are.
Okay. Well, Jay, we have a question from a listener right here who asks, what is your response to the George Floyd protests and calls for defunding the police? As police chief, will these events shape how you run the department here?
Well, I think there's a little bit of confusion on what defund the police means. I've heard one side say, you know, they want to take police funding and use it more towards funding counseling. I've also our other social service resources, and I've also heard defund the police means to do away with the police, shut down the police departments, and, you know, come up with some other form of enforcing the rule of law. So I think it's more of a conversation that still needs to be had. I think no community in modern society can actually function without the protective services of properly trained and properly minded police officers to serve and protect. Okay. I do think resources should be allocated to looking at some of the root causes of things that are happening in society, like domestic violence, child abuse. You know, sometimes when you have someone that's shoplifting, there's a big difference in shoplifting for the latest, you know, pair of shoes that just came out versus shoplifting baby formula to feed your kid. You know, if there were resources in place and services in place to where law enforcement officers could refer a particular person to those resources, sometimes you can prevent a future crime from happening. So defunding the police, I don't think is the correct move because, like I said, law-abiding citizens are going to obey the law regardless of if the police officer is present or not. But criminals are not going to obey the law. And if they know that the police aren't going to be present, they know the police resources aren't there, then they're going to victimize more people knowing that they can get away with it a little bit easier.
You talked a little bit about kind of the root of the problem. What are your thoughts on reallocating some of those funds from law enforcement to fund things such as education, mental health treatment, substance abuse treatment, housing, and other human needs?
Like I said, you don't want to take money away from police departments because a lot of police departments aren't, you know, fully staffed or fully equipped or fully trained right now. So you don't want to take resources away from police departments, but those resources do need to come from somewhere. And I think that government entities need to look at how they can come up with those funds and allocate them for, you know, programs to be put in place like, you know, substance abuse, some type of family services and things like that. But just taking money from police departments, like I said, the way most law enforcement agencies that I know of right now are way understaffed. There's actually a nationwide issue with, you know, recruiting and retention right now. So if you take funding away from agencies to where they can't get up to proper staffing, and you're taking money away from the training that needs to be in place anyway. And you need to not just put someone through a police academy, but you need to have continuing education hours available to officers to keep them up to date on the latest, you know, court decisions that come out, the latest police equipment that comes out, the latest tactics or protocols that come out. Policing is something that evolves every day. And if you don't keep your officers properly trained throughout their career, then, you know, you have instances like you had in Minneapolis. The Montgomery Police Department has had policies in place against, you know, keeping someone on their stomach once handcuffed for, you know, a while. We've had a policy that prevents our officers from using chokeholds on subjects for a while, long before this happened in Minneapolis. So, like I said, having even senior and seasoned officers retrained is going to be hindered if you take funding away from police departments.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to KUCB 89.7 FM. I'm Hope McKinney, and I'm here with Major Jay King from the Montgomery Police Department in Alabama, who's a finalist for Unalaska's open police chief position. If you have any questions, you can give us a call at 581-1888 or email us at news@kucb.org. We have another question from a listener that is asking how you interpret the difference between being not being a racist and being actively anti-racist. Can you speak a little bit about that?
I'm not sure if I understood the question. You're saying the difference between not being a racist and
being actively anti-racist. I think they're wondering what steps you're taking as an individual to be anti-racist.
I was just raised better, I guess. I mean, I try to look at everybody as being, you know, a citizen that I took an oath to defend and protect. I don't look at anyone on a traffic stop and in regards to what type of car they're driving or what their address is or what zip code they come from. I look at them as a person who was doing 10 miles an hour over the posted speed limit. And I try to treat everybody the same regardless of what zip code they come from. I was born, you know, into a military family. I served in the military. I mean, I've been introduced to cultures, you know, pretty much all over the world. I spent a summer in China. I spent a summer in Korea. I've been to Japan. I've been to Costa Rica. When I was in the military, I served in Honduras and Panama. I travel a lot on a personal nature, and I love, you know, studying history, and I love studying other cultures and other, you know, areas of the world. I've never thought of myself as being, you know, more important than anybody that I'm sworn to serve. That's the whole purpose in me being in law enforcement, me serving in the military, was to protect and serve others. Like I said, I don't care if you're my next door neighbor or someone that lives on the other side of town from me. If, you know, I catch you speeding, I'm going to talk to you and see if I can't get you to slow down. When I was in traffic homicide, I'd write two warnings for every one ticket that I wrote. I don't think everybody has to get a ticket. I don't think everybody has to go to jail. A lot of times it's, you know, knowing how to talk to somebody and treating someone with respect until it comes to a point where you have to either put handcuffs on them or write them a ticket and let them go. But the most important thing is knowing that regardless of where someone was born, where someone was raised, they still deserve the same respect that you would want someone to give your mother if they pulled your mother over.
Okay. And I think a lot of people right now are questioning their privilege and taking steps to actively address their own biases. We have a listener who's asking what steps you'll be taking to build a police department here that is anti-racist, particularly in this moment right now that we're seeing where there's this national conversation about the role of policing. We're seeing incidents around the country. Are there steps that you've thought of that you'll be taking to build a police department here in Unalaska that is anti-racist?
One of the things that I learned when I was going through the CLEAR accreditation process was that a department that is consistently made up demographically the same as the community it serves, you have that ability in-house for everyone to learn and respect about the other cultures that are in the community. Montgomery, I would say, is probably about 40-45% black, 40-45% white, probably a good percentage of Asian and Hispanic community members. Our department tries to make itself that same ratio of makeup as the community we serve. And that's one of the things I would love to be able to do here is make sure that every aspect of the community here is represented in the police department. A lot of people don't get to travel and observe other cultures the way I have. You know, I've learned things when I was in Costa Rica about how they view law enforcement and how the family structure interacts with law enforcement, and it's completely different than the culture in Korea. You know, and having that availability to make sure that the Unalaska Police Department is similar demographically to the community we serve. Like I said, if one officer is able to teach another officer, you know, how they interact with someone, you know, do they make eye contact? Do they shake hands? Do they, you know, nod heads when they greet one another? You know, being able to understand that that cultural difference, I think, will help the department. One of the things that I would also like to focus on is developing some, you know, if it's not already in place, some cultural diversity training for the department, and it's something that can be done in service-wise. The Montgomery Police Department, which is the agency I'm from, teaches a class to every basic recruit, and it goes back to the civil rights movement all the way through modern day. Everything that we've had within our department that's been controversial is covered in that training, from the bus boycotts to, you know, the arrest or apprehension or the mishandling of evidence. Everything is addressed in that cultural diversity training that we host with our recruits. And the reason we do that is because Montgomery is such a historical place and has had such a dynamic impact on how policing is done across the nation. And we're just the capital city of Alabama. And like I said, I'd like to think that I can bring that experience and that knowledge and that desire to make sure that the police department here has that same high standard of interacting with the different cultures that we serve.
And like you were just talking about, I mean, Unalaska is an incredibly diverse community. We have someone who is asking how you'll promote and cultivate staff that is aware of differences, be it race, religion, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, physical or mental disability, or age, and be able to serve these intersectional communities that we have here on this island.
Well, first, I'm going to have to learn everything that I can about the community here. And the way that I'm going to do that is by interacting with the community. I'm the type person, regardless of my rank, I believe in getting out on the street and meeting people and being a police officer first. Rank is just a set of responsibilities that I have, but my badge and my patch have always said police. And, you know, in order to be a police officer, you have to know the community you serve. I'll give you a little bit of background since you mentioned a couple of things. And your question is, growing up, my mother was disabled. My mother and father divorced when I was young, so therefore my mother raised me. So, I mean, I lived in some of the communities that were probably a little bit less than what you would think is being culturally diverse. And being raised by a mother that was, you know, physically handicapped, I knew growing up, you know, how she was challenged with things. And when, you know, we had hurdles that we had to go through, I learned a lot from her character. And I learned a lot about the respect that she should have been given versus what she was given. So, like I said earlier, when you're interacting with someone in the community, you have to, for a police officer, they need to ask themselves two questions. Would they do that, or would they have another officer do that to their parent if they were interacting with them? Or would they do that if I was standing next to them as their police chief? And if they wouldn't do it with me standing there as their police chief, or if they wouldn't want another officer to treat their parent in the way that they're treating someone, then chances are they shouldn't be doing it. But my goal is to learn the community, get to know as many people in the community as I can, and make sure that what I know is the same that every other officer in the department knows. I'm going to encourage them to participate in, you know, community events. I know y'all have a 4th of July parade coming up where the graduating class of 2020 is going to be the Grand Marshal. I think that would be an excellent opportunity for officers to interact with the community, because, you know, kids are going to be there, their parents are going to be there, family members are going to be there. It's a great opportunity to, you know, get to see the diversity of the community. I know there's a competition coming up, hosted by the Rod and Gun Club. I think that's another opportunity to interact with the community. I think the police department should be well represented there, and I hope they are. But the biggest thing is putting together training based on the diversity of this community, and make sure that whenever we do hire officers and we bring them here, that they sit through that continuing education training. And the officers that are already here, if they've been here a short time and they come from outside the community, maybe we can offer that training to them as well.
And a few moments ago, you talked a little bit about how you grew up. We have a question from a listener that asks how you, as a white man, have benefited from structural racism that has existed in the U.S. for the last five centuries.
Well, let's see. When I was in, like I said, elementary school, I lived in a community where I was one of three white families in the community. I was one of, I think, less than 10 white families that attended the school I attended. And it was because my mother was handicapped and we lived in, you know, government-subsidized housing in a community that was predominantly black. I think that I wasn't afforded whatever privilege someone may think I had because of my upbringing and because of where I lived. I was, you know, at the same advantage or disadvantage to the other people that lived in my community. I think that having a mother that motivated me to always do the right thing, and an uncle who was a Marine and taught me growing up that the best thing you can do is, you know, serve your community, a father who was the Army that, you know, prompted me to do the same thing, you know, grow up and seek out a profession that allows you to serve your community. And because I knew what I wanted to do when I grew up, that is what guided me in everything that I did. That's what guided me to focus on school. Like I said, I went from growing up in government housing to owning my first house by the time I was 25. And that wasn't because I was white. It's because I was raised to respect others and raised to monitor my actions in accordance to what I wanted to do with my life. I couldn't be a police officer if I grew up smoking dope. I couldn't be a police officer if I grew up breaking into cars and breaking into houses. So I knew not to do those things because I knew what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I mean, I'm pretty much Scott Irish and Cherokee Indian on my mother's side, and I think Italian German on my father's side. So I'm a mixture of Native American and European of ancestry. People look at me as being white, but I do have Native American culture that I respect because my grandmother on my mother's side was Cherokee Indian. Like I said, you can look at me and say I'm white all day long, but that's not all that I am.
We were just speaking a little bit about you as a white man having benefited or not benefited from the structural racism that's existed in this country for the last five centuries. I was wondering, before we move on, you talked about that you have Irish heritage, you have Cherokee heritage, but that you represent as a white man. Do you think the color of your skin has impacted your life?
I've been judged because of the way I look. I mean, when you serve a community like in a law enforcement capacity, people don't know you when you pull them over on a traffic stop. They see that, hey, I just got pulled over by a white cop. That's what they see. They don't know that I grew up in Sherwood Apartments, which is one of the areas of town that we have to provide a lot of police resources to because of the issues that occur there. People don't see me as a person who come from Sherwood. They see me as being the white cop that's pulling them over. You can't look at me and tell that I'm part Cherokee. So no one says, hey, I'm being pulled over by an Indian cop. They say I'm being pulled over by a white cop. At the same time, you know, you have to not judge someone by the way they look or what kind of car they drive or what their address zip code is. And officers are judged on sometimes just being an officer. Just because, you know, something happens involving another officer and an individual that they come in contact with doesn't mean that I'm going to treat everybody the same way. Like I said, I've always been of the mindset that not everybody has to go to jail, not everybody has to get a ticket. You know, regardless of, you know, if you're doing 5 over or 10 over, if I'm during our interaction, you have your driver's license, you have your tag receipt, you have your insurance card, and you acknowledge that you were, you know, speeding inappropriately and you need to slow down, you get a warning, regardless of, like I said, where you live or what you're driving. But at the same time, if the person, when you walk up and you say, you know, my name is Major King, reason I'm stopping you for speeding, and they see your driver's license, tag receipt, and insurance card, and the first words out of their mouth is, you stopped me because I'm black, it's like, well, no, my radar gun doesn't tell me what color the driver is. It just says that you're doing 60 and a 40. But you have to be able to explain to that person why you pulled them over and that make them feel comfortable in knowing that had they not been doing 20 miles an hour over the posted speed limit, you never would have come in contact with them. You never would have had a reason to pull them over. Like I said, as a police officer, I feel that sometimes I'm prejudged. And as a white police officer, I think sometimes I'm prejudged just because of what goes on in the media and because of what is said in social media. And some of it is true and some of it's not accurate at all.
Okay. And so here in Unalaska, it's been a really long time since we've had a permanent police chief. Unalaska has been without a full-time head of the Department of Public Safety since the retirement of Mike Holman in January of 2018. Then Jennifer Shockley served as acting chief for about a year before resigning. And then the city decided to bring back former Chief John Lucking on a temporary contract in March of last year, and he's still here. I know you ran for the Alabama House of Representatives 2 times, with your last run ending in 2019. We have a listener who asks, do you plan to build a long-term career here as a police chief, or is this job a stepping stone to larger political aspirations?
No. My involvement in the House District 74 race was to be able to continue to serve as a police officer for the city of Montgomery while serving as a representative in the state house. And the reason I got involved in that race the first time was because the candidate that was pretty much a shoe-in for the seat was not planning on fulfilling his obligation. And I thought that it would be an opportunity for me to bring, you know, issues such as mental health awareness, funding for some social service issues such as, you know, domestic violence and drug treatment to light. And then when I ran the second time, it was for the same reason. If you looked at the things that I focused on, it was, you know, about knowing what police officers have to deal with on the street, make sure that funding is there for mental health treatment and mental health professionals and mental health facilities, because, in fact, a lot of the interactions we come in contact with on a daily basis, some of it can be tracked back to mental health, some of it can be tracked back to family issues, and some of it can be tracked back to drug issues. And defunding those three things has basically made the role of a police officer that more complicated, because now when we come in contact with someone, we have to be able to ascertain within a short period of time, is this person under the influence of narcotics? Is he having a mental health crisis issue? Or, you know, are they a victim of some type of family dispute to where they're acting out? But if, you know, governments fund those things to where people can get the treatment they need, get the help they need, it puts police officers back in the position to where they can be police officers again, you know, instead of trying to wear many hats and diffuse situations that, you know, without the proper training, it makes it hard. In my department, I'm actually a de-escalation instructor. I train other officers on how to come in contact with someone who's in crisis and to diffuse that situation by, you know, verbally speaking to the person, making them feel comfortable, finding out, you know, what the key issue is that needs to be addressed, and keeping the incident from escalating into something where you have to be physical.
We're coming towards the end of our program. We have about 10 more minutes. But back to talking a little bit about diversity in our community and the police department here. How have you worked to ensure that women and other minorities are represented in your department? And we have a question from a listener that asks, what are the benefits to having more women in policing?
For the first thing, as administrative division commander, I had direct oversight over our training and recruiting section. Recruiting was geared towards, you know, making sure that the police department was properly staffed. As far as numbers go, one of the things that I did was I worked with our recruiting commander to make sure that she was always up to date on the genetic makeup of the police department in comparison to that of our community. So we try to make sure that not just male and female was accurately representative, but also the different cultures and ethnicities within the city. As far as women in law enforcement, I believe that a woman can do just about anything a man can do. I don't think that that should even be a question. Serving in the military, I had female soldiers side by side with me throughout training and throughout my entire career in the military. As a matter of fact, one of our officers that just retired from the Montgomery Police Department was actually in my National Guard unit, who served as our first sergeant over the unit that I was in. I had nothing but respect for her ability and her knowledge and capabilities. Like I said, I've never thought anything could be a hindrance to having females in uniform serving beside me.
And if you end up being a police chief here in this community, how do you intend to enhance the existing relationships between public safety and other community agencies like the schools, the faith community, domestic violence program, et cetera, here?
Well, that goes back to community policing. If you know who your community leaders are and you know who your church leaders are, then whenever a question comes up or a debate comes up, you know that you can reach out to them and get a better feel of, you know, things that people won't say to the police department, they'll say to, you know, fellow church members. Church leaders have a tendency to have more the heart of the people that are members of their church, and it'd be good to have that working relationship to where, you know, if something happens within the community, that we can reach out to them and let's work together to solve the problems. And also, it's a good means of pushing stuff back out to the community. You know, if there's a question as to how a police officer performed on a traffic stop or during an arrest, you know, having those community members that have the relationship with the police department to where when we try to push out information, the community leaders and the church leaders know that when we tell them something, we're being, you know, transparent. They know that we're providing them as much information that we can, as long as we're not hindering a current or open case or investigation. I think being involved in schools is always an essential aspect of law enforcement, because I take part in a program that we have in Montgomery called I Lead. One of the things that I do in regards to that program is I set up like an activities day for the classes that are participating to go on like a boat ride where members of the police department are on the cruise, and basically gives the children an opportunity to interact with law enforcement, see them in a different environment than just, you know, when we're responding to their house and having to, you know, arrest a family member or whatever. The other thing is we do a demonstration of, you know, police tactics, police equipment. We'll do like a canine demonstration for them. We'll let them, you know, climb all through the equipment we have, climb on the boat, climb on the, you know, police cars, and, you know, turn lights and sirens on. And I think it helps build that rapport to where, you know, if something was to happen to a child, they know that, hey, the police officers are there for us, and I can go talk to them and tell them what happened. At the same time, if you have a good resource officer program in a school, the school resource officer can build that rapport with the kids to where you can, you know, you can identify those that may need a little guidance to make sure that they stay in a position where they don't have to worry about them doing something wrong later in life, because they know that they've had that interaction. They serve as a role model and a guide to, you know, encourage them to do the right thing and treat others with respect and not infringe on the rights of others.
Okay, yeah, so you're talking a little bit about kind of creating this healthy relationship between communities and a police force. We have a question from a listener that asks, how has the militarization of the police department contributed to the problems we are seeing between police and communities right now?
And that is, I want to say, a lack of guidance on the agencies that are having those issues. And what I mean by that is the equipment that we use, you know, the ballistic armor, the weapons in the vehicles, as far as, you know, having an AR-15 or a shotgun, you know, the tactical overthrow vest that we use, it's not in response to law-abiding citizens. A lot of that is in response to criminal activity. You know, when you had the incident, I want to say it was L.A. back in maybe the 70s or 80s, you had a bank robbery where the bad guys had, you know, assault weapons, and the police officers that showed up to arrest them were carrying, you know, revolvers. Well, you can't address an issue when you're less equipped than the issue you're trying to address. And by having those, you know, community involvement events where, you know, kids climb through the police cars and they see all the equipment that we have, and when you have a tactical team that runs through a tactical operation and show the citizens why we do what we do, they don't feel as intimidated by the way we're equipped. But if the only time they see it is when it's deployed, then I think that's where you have that negative image of, oh, they're just like the military. And it's not that. It's, you know, if you have a barricaded subject, you know, and they have, you know, explosives and all this stuff, you can't go in there toting a nightstick and no ballistic armor, wearing a body vest or anything, and apprehend someone like that. You have to be equipped to address whatever threats you have facing the community. And our equipment, our tactics are meant to, address a threat, not to intimidate law-abiding citizens. And like I said, I think that agencies that have those misconceptions are those agencies that don't interact with their community the way they should, that they don't let the community see the training that they go through and why they go through the training. One of the things we do at the Montgomery Police Department is we have a Citizens Police Academy. And that Citizens Police Academy is for, you know, community members and community leaders to go through, where they learn some of the same information that is taught to our police officers. And they get to see firsthand why police officers are equipped with a handgun, a shotgun, and a long rifle. They get to see why our police cars have partitions between the prisoner area and the officer area. They understand why that our seats in the cars are form-fitted hard plastic or fiberglass seating. They know why we have that equipment in place, because they've understood what's happened in the past that has caused an issue to where now we have to do this modification to make sure that same issue doesn't come up in the past that happened in the past.
Okay, well, we're coming up to the very end of our program. We have less than 2 minutes left. And just from my standpoint here as a reporter at KUCB, our current police chief tries to be very transparent with the media here. Just very quickly, what are your thoughts on being transparent with us here at KUCB moving forward?
As I mentioned earlier, I believe that if there's a question on how the police department is operating, or if there's, you know, an issue that comes up within the community and the police department is involved in that aspect, I believe that as much information that can be pushed out without interfering with an ongoing investigation or an ongoing case, that information should be shared, because, like I said, we are public servants. We're here to serve the community and make sure that we're as transparent as possible. Like I said, I think that if we provide information to the media, we provide information to our community leaders, we provide information to our church leaders, that information gets pushed out from sources that they trust, not just taking it from us, but taking it from the media and the church leaders and the community leaders as well.
All right. Well, thank you, Jay. We're at the end of our program. If I wasn't able to get to your question, I apologize. I'm Hope McKinney, and you've been listening to KUCB's live show with Major Jay King from the Montgomery Police Department in Alabama. He's a finalist for the position of police chief in Unalaska. Thanks for joining me, Jay.
Thank you.